Happy Friday, Aviators, and welcome to another episode of The Aviator's Guide. Thanks for popping by today, whether you're watching this on YouTube or listening to this on your favorite podcast platform. As always, I am your host and friendly neighborhood pilot, Holly Bellino. If you're new to The Aviator's Guide, thanks for joining me today. I love connecting with new people, learning more about aviation whenever I can, and helping my fellow pilots as well. So if you do have any questions, don't hesitate to reach out to me at youraviatorsguide@gmail.com. Now, if you are interested in military flying, I hope you were able to catch my last episode in January, where I had on a very special guest, my husband, Joseph Bellino, who is an Army aviator trained in the Black Hawk and Lakota helicopters. In that episode, we discussed how he got to where he is today and how you can do it too if you are indeed interested in becoming a badass military helicopter pilot for the Army. Due to recent events, some of you may not want to go that route, but it's still a very cool and very fun option. Just ask my husband. So we're just going to dive right into this somber yet necessary topic for today, which is why my usual chipper attitude may become quite diluted. First, I would like to start off by expressing my deepest condolences for the families of the ones who were tragically lost at the crash near Ronald Reagan Washington National Airport. I am praying for all the souls that were lost that day, as well as the air traffic controllers who have to deal with the aftermath. To all of you air traffic controllers out there, you have always been and will always be my heroes. I know you all are getting a bunch of flack right now due to this awful occurrence, but you all, as well as maintenance crews, are the backbone of aviation. I usually lovingly refer to ATC as mom and dad of the sky, because not only do I respect you, but you're strict, you're disciplined, and you always do your best to keep us safe. Everyone is unfortunately playing the blame game as to how a Black Hawk helicopter and the CRJ-700 collided on January 29th around 9 p.m. a few days ago. But I really know it's just because everybody wants answers to how something so horrible could have happened. American Airlines Flight 5342, operating as PSA Airlines, was flying over the Potomac River on short final for runway 33, and they were cleared to land when it made contact with a Black Hawk helicopter flying at 300 feet AGL, or above ground level, which in this area is about the same as MSL, or mean sea level. One of the Black Hawk pilots had confirmed with ATC that they were going to see and avoid the CRJ on short final. And if they were flying a specific route along the Potomac, then they should be no higher than 200 feet AGL. Once the two aircraft collided, all 64 souls aboard the airplane and all three aboard the helicopter perished. We all have questions about this crash. Was the Black Hawk flying 100 feet higher than it was permitted? Did neither of the aircraft's TCAS, or traffic collision and avoidance systems, give a warning? Why are helicopters allowed to fly so close to Reagan Field with aircraft on short final? Why are we trusting see and avoid procedures in one of the world's busiest airspaces? And what can we do to prevent this in the future to ensure our safety of flight? While we're all speculating, let's remember that this is what the NTSB does, or the National Transportation Safety Board, and I have faith that they will figure it out and then we can all learn from it. So we can speculate as much as we want, but let's remember that January 29th was the worst day of some of our fellow Americans' lives. They lost loved ones along with hope and happiness, so be kind and respectful. I would also like to extend my condolences to the families of the seven souls that were lost in the Learjet 55 crash in Philadelphia and to all the locals that were affected by the impact. On January 31st, just 2 days after the Black Hawk and CRJ collision, this Learjet operating by a Jet Rescue Air Ambulance left Northeast Philadelphia Airport with an 11-year-old patient, her mother, two medical professionals, and two pilots. It crashed less than 1 minute after takeoff, killing one person on the ground and injuring at least 24. We don't know what happened with this crash yet either, but the CVR, or cockpit voice recorder, was discovered, so hopefully that will help us learn some answers. The CVR, also known as the black box, which is actually orange in color, was found 8 feet below the surface at the crash site, which is incredible, but not entirely surprising, as a Learjet was falling through the sky at a rate of 11,000 feet per minute before it crashed near the Roosevelt Mall. On a semi-brighter note, the Airbus A320 that was being operated by United Airlines that caught fire on their takeoff roll at Houston was evacuated without injuries to the 109 souls on board. This happened on the morning of February 2nd due to engine issues, and that's all that's really being said about that, so hopefully the NTSB finds out more. I'm so happy that everyone was able to evacuate safely, and I'm slightly surprised because those emergency slides are quite steep. And I could easily see me, myself, getting injured trying to come down and dismount off of one of those. When we did it in flight attendant training, we had a padded floor and also a wall at the end to help us stop. I'm sure it's a lot different in a real situation. So while this significantly onslaught of aviation accidents may seem all of a sudden, aviation accidents actually happen a lot more than you think. They're just not always broadcasted for the world to see. That depends on time, location, aircraft type, injuries, fatalities, and who's on board. While I don't know every accident that's happened in aviation, I do know this. At least one pilot, maintenance technician, and/or air traffic controller has learned from the experience and improved their skills because of it, whether they saw it, heard about it, or experienced it. And as faint, thin, possibly gray, and difficult to see as that silver lining is, it's there. A fatal aircraft accident occurs, we learn, we adjust, we progress. Let's go over a few examples. On August 2nd, 1985, Delta Airlines Flight 191 was operating a Lockheed L-1011 TriStar on approach into Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. Shortly after encountering a microburst at 1,000 feet above the ground, Flight 191 crashed, despite the pilot's efforts to gain control, killing all 271 souls on board and two people on the ground. A microburst is, in my opinion, one of the scariest things when it comes to weather, besides icing, that is. It's a natural phenomenon that tends to last for 5 to 15 minutes and includes wind shear and a downdraft that can be as strong as 6,000 feet per minute of force. These microbursts can cause airspeed fluctuations from 30 to 90 knots and exist in a ring of 1 to 2 miles in diameter. As you enter the microburst, you usually experience headwinds causing an increase in performance, meaning an increase in airspeed. Soon after the headwinds comes that strong downdraft, which will turn into a tailwind as you exit, or try to exit, meaning you get a decrease in performance and lose airspeed. You can experience a microburst at any altitude, but they're of course the most dangerous when you're at lower altitudes. This unique accident brought about newer and more intense training for wind shear avoidance and recovery, requirements for turbine commercial air carriers to have some sort of wind shear warning system, and there was an advisory circular written just on the topic of wind shear. For those of you who don't know what an advisory circular, or AC, is, it's a document written by the FAA to go into more detail on a particular topic. So if you can't find your answer in an FAA book, I'm sure there's an advisory circular for it. 11 years after the microburst accident, on July 17, 1996, a Boeing 747, operating as TWA-800, was on its way to Paris, when 11 minutes after takeoff, it blew up over the Atlantic Ocean, killing all 230 souls on board. This terrifying accident was all due to worn and improperly arranged wires that short-circuited, sparking the fuel probe and igniting fuel vapors inside the fuel tank, creating a massive explosion. As a result of this accident, the FAA increased safety measures for aircraft maintenance, and they created an additional 150 airworthiness directives to reduce fuel tank flammability and to address deteriorating system wiring. 4 years after that, on July 25, 2000, a Concorde, known as the only ever supersonic passenger aircraft, operating as Air France 4590, crashed into an airport hotel shortly after takeoff when two of its four engines exploded, killing all 109 souls on board and four on the ground. This catastrophic event was all because of FOD, or foreign object debris, that fell off the previous departing aircraft. This FOD, which was a piece of metal, blew the American-made tire. The rubber from that tire then hit the fuel tank with such force that it exploded. The Concorde had sadly retired 2 years after this accident due to high cost and profit loss, but not before changes were made, including stronger tires for the Concorde, reinforced fuel tanks, and more stringent runway examinations for FOD. In other accidents, most of us painfully remember what happened on September 11th, 2001. The United States of America was devastated when four commercial airplanes were hijacked, resulting in a total of almost 3,000 deaths. American Airlines Flight 77 was flown straight into the Pentagon. American Airlines Flight 11 was directed at the North Tower of the World Trade Center. United Airlines 175 hit the South Tower of the World Trade Center. And as the passengers of United Airlines Flight 93 learned about what happened to the other three airplanes, they decided to fight back. So the hijackers drove the plane into a rural field in Pennsylvania to prevent it from being taken back over and returned to an airport. At the time of these infamous events, did you know that knives with blades less than or equal to a size of 4 inches were actually allowed on the airplane? That the flight attendants were given keys to the flight deck? That three of the five hijackers for Flight 77 were given additional screenings and still made it through security? I was a flight attendant for American Airlines for 6 years, so trust me when I say this would not happen today. The sheer amount of protocols and procedures that have been put into place to make air travel safer is a phenomenal and positive outcome of those horrible occurrences that happened on 9/11. The Transportation and Security Administration, or TSA, was created just 2 months afterwards. Flight attendants do not have keys to the flight deck anymore, and knives are just as banned as smoking is for passengers. Not to mention, Americans now have a very strong sense of camaraderie and still have PTSD from 9/11. And I have a very good feeling that hijackers would not make it past the horde of people that fly commercially today, especially since most flights are overbooked and completely full. Because of everything we learned from 9/11 and the new systems that were put into place, we are no longer in the golden age of hijacking. Yeah, that was a thing. Hijackings were so prevalent from 1968 to 1972 that it was deemed the golden age of hijacking. And it ended in 1973 because, you guessed it, new protocols were put into place. 1973 is the year that screenings began for passengers and carry-on baggage. Since 9/11, some terrorists have still tried and failed, like Richard the Shoe Bomber, who made his own exploding shoes. Thankfully, the crew and passengers caught him and restrained him before he was able to light the bomb. The tragedies continued a couple months after 9/11. On November 12, 2001, an Airbus 300 operating as American Airlines Flight 587 was climbing through 13,000 feet on its way to the Dominican Republic when its vertical stabilizer separated from the aircraft, eliminating the ability for it to fly. The separation of the vertical stabilizer was indirectly a cause of, believe it or not, improper flight training. That training instructed pilots to use varying rudder inputs to prevent the aircraft from rolling when it encounters wake turbulence. With this in mind, the pilot in control of the aircraft was using such adverse force on the rudders that, when combined with his aileron inputs, put so much stress on the aircraft that the vertical stabilizer broke off, causing the plane to crash in and killing all 260 souls on board.
And five on the ground.
American Airlines took immediate action for improvement, including changing training procedures for wake turbulence, creating more realistic simulators, and installing a warning light in the aircraft indicating dangerous levels of rudder input. Moving on to February 12, 2009, Colgan Air Flight 3407 was preparing to land in Buffalo, New York, when it stalled and crashed into the ground, killing all 49 souls on board and one person on the ground. This accident, like many others, was very sadly due to pilot error. The aircraft was fully configured to land with full flaps and landing gear down, but the airspeed was slower than it should have been because there was icing on the control surfaces of the aircraft. And every pilot out there knows that your approach speeds are to be increased when icing exists. We use these faster airspeeds to help with our controllability of the aircraft, since icing not only increases drag by up to 40%, but reduces lift by up to 30%. And with the flaps being full and the gear being down, drag was already significant. So what happened? They stalled. To all of my pilots listening, you know the stall recovery, yes? The basic principles are to increase power and to lower the angle of attack to increase airflow over the control surfaces. These pilots added power, but instead of pitching down to break the stall, they pitched up, immensely exacerbating the situation. As much as we can all easily exclaim, "What an amateur mistake," it's a lot easier for us to judge them when we're here safely on the ground. You never know what you would do in that situation, but you only know what you hope you would do. It comes down to focus. They weren't focused. They were distracted. They weren't using sterile flight deck rules of no redundant talking during taxi takeoff and landing. They were tired and not feeling 100%. It could happen to any of us. If you don't think it could, then you need to go look up the good old hazardous attitude named invulnerability. If nothing else, these accidents remind us pilots to follow the I'm safe checklist, continue to use ADM or aeronautical decision making and judgment, and CRM, crew resource management, as well as doing everything that we can to continue to be the best pilots we can be. It's our duty and responsibility to be safe. Now, I could keep going with these accident cases, as there are many that have taught us lessons, both commercially and non-commercially. And if you want to keep looking into them, I included a link in the show notes to a really good FAA website that includes all the details of lots of cases, including lessons learned. I know many people in the United States right now are very wary of air travel due to the recent series of unfortunate events. For those of you that are, take a deep breath and try to relax. Because despite all the stories I told you and the crap all the aviation community has been through in the past week, air travel is still the safest way to travel. Here are some interesting and slightly morbid statistics for you guys to prove it. About 1 in every 100 Americans die in a car accident. About 1 in every 243,000 Americans die in a train travel accident. And about 1 in every 11 million Americans die in an aircraft accident. And the majority of those aviation fatalities don't happen on those commercial airlines that most Americans take. They happen in general aviation flights. Flights with many pilots flying solo, with assorted levels of experience, in all kinds of weather, and all kinds of aircraft with varying maintenance conditions. So at the end of the day, don't be afraid to air travel. I do understand your concerns. They're concerns we all share, but aviation is still safe and we're always working on improving it. And if you're a pilot, be sure you're always working on improving your skills. Dissecting aviation accidents and learning about what happened is one fantastic way to do that. There are a couple of YouTube channels I recommend for your continued education on the subject, and those are The Flight Channel and Pilot Debrief. Well, that's all I've got for you guys today. I hope that you've learned something that will make you a better pilot. And if you've ever had any accidents or incidents happen to you or near you that you'd like me to share with other pilots, send them my way to youraviatorsguide@gmail.com. We can all learn from each other, and I will keep your name anonymous if you wish it. Before you go, please like, subscribe, rate, review, and follow my show to help me keep spreading the word. Until then, stay safe and always use your checklist, and I'll see you later, aviators.